vision is that. It is the same old European vision. And Kosazana looked me straight in the eyes. It is my grandchildren who are going to visit your continent and travel on your high-speed trains and visit that exotic ice hotel I've heard you have up in northern Sweden. It is going to take a long time. We know that. It is going to take lots of wise decisions and large investments. But my 50-year vision is that Africans will become welcome tourists in Europe and not unwanted refugees. Then she broke into a broad, warm smile. But the graphics were really nice. Now let's go and have some coffee. Over coffee, I reflected on my mistake. I remembered a conversation from 33 years earlier with my first African friend, the Mozambican mining engineer Neherewa Masalina. He had looked at me with that same face. I was working as a doctor in Nacala in Mozambique, and Neherewa came with us on a family outing to the beach. The coast in Mozambique is unbelievably beautiful and was still hardly exploited, and we used to be almost alone there at the weekends. When I saw that there were 15 or 20 families on the mile-long stretch of sand, I said, "Oh, what a shame that there are so many families on the beach today." Neherewa grabbed my arm, just as Nkosana was to do years later, and said, "Hans, my reaction is the opposite. I feel great pain and sadness seeing this beach. Look at the city center there in the distance. 80,000 people live there, which means 40,000 children. It's the weekend, and only 40 of them made it to the beach, one in 1,000. When I got my mining education in East Germany, I went to the beaches of Rostock at the weekend, and they were full. Thousands of children having a wonderful time. I want Nacala to be like Rostock. I want all children to go to the beach on a Sunday, instead of working in their parents' fields or sitting in the slums. It will take a long time, but that is what I want." Then he let go of my arm and helped my children to get their swimming gear out of the car. 33 years later, addressing the African Union after a professional lifetime of collaboration with African scholars and institutions, I was absolutely convinced that I shared their great vision. I thought I was one of the few Europeans who could see what change was possible. But after delivering the most cherished lecture of my life, I realized that I was still stuck in an old, static, colonial mindset. In spite of all that my African friends and colleagues had taught me over the years, I was still not really imagining they could ever catch up with us. I was still failing to see that all people, families, children, will struggle hard to achieve just that, so they can also go to the beach. Factfulness. Factfulness is recognizing that many things, including people, countries, religions, and cultures, appear to be constant just because the change is happening slowly, and remembering that even small, slow changes gradually add up to big changes. To control the destiny instinct, remember slow change is still change. Keep track of gradual improvements. A small change every year can translate into a huge change over decades. Update your knowledge. Some knowledge goes out of date quickly. Technology, countries, societies, cultures, and religions are constantly changing. Talk to Grandpa. If you want to be reminded of how values have changed, think about your grandparents' values and how they differ from yours. Collect examples of cultural change. Challenge the idea that today's culture must also have been yesterday's and will also be tomorrow's. Chapter 8. The Single Perspective Instinct. Why governments should not be mistaken for nails, and why shoes and bricks sometimes tell you more than numbers. Who can we trust? Forming your worldview by relying on the media would be like forming your view about me by looking only at a picture of my foot. Sure, my foot is part of me, but it's a pretty ugly part. I have better parts. My arms are unremarkable, but quite fine. My face is okay. It isn't that the picture of my foot is deliberately lying about me, but it isn't showing you the whole of me. Where, then, shall we get our information from, if not from the media? Who can we trust? How about experts? People who devote their working lives to understanding their chosen slice of the world. Well, you have to be very careful here, too. The Single Perspective Instinct. We find simple ideas very attractive. We enjoy that moment of insight. We enjoy feeling we really understand or know something. And it is easy to take off down a slippery slope from one attention-grabbing simple idea to a feeling that this idea beautifully explains or is the beautiful solution for lots of other things. The world becomes simple. All problems have a single cause, something we must always be completely against. Or all problems have a single solution, something we must always be for. Everything is simple. There's just one small issue. We completely misunderstand the world. I call this preference for single causes and single solutions the single perspective instinct. For example, the simple and beautiful idea of the free market can lead to the simplistic idea that all problems have a single cause, government interference, which we must always oppose, and that the solution to all problems is to liberate market forces by reducing taxes and removing regulations, which we must always support. Alternatively, the simple and beautiful idea of equality can lead to the simplistic idea that all problems are caused by inequality, which we should always oppose, and that the solution to all problems is redistribution of resources, which we should always support. It saves a lot of time to think like this. You can have opinions and answers without having to learn about a problem from scratch, and you can get on with using your brain for other tasks. But it's not so useful if you like to understand the world. Being always in favor of or always against any particular idea makes you blind to information that doesn't fit your perspective. This is usually a bad approach if you like to understand reality. Instead, constantly test your favorite ideas for weaknesses. Be humble about the extent of your expertise. Be curious about new information that doesn't fit, and information from other fields. And rather than talking only to people who agree with you or collecting examples that fit your ideas, see people who contradict you, disagree with you, and put forward different ideas as a great resource for understanding the world. I have been wrong about the world so many times. Sometimes coming up against reality is what helps me see my mistakes, but often it is talking to and trying to understand someone with different ideas. If this means you don't have time to form so many opinions, so what? Wouldn't you rather have few opinions that are right than many that are wrong? I have found two main reasons why people often focus on a single perspective when it comes to understanding the world. The obvious one is political ideology, and I will come to that later in this chapter. The other is professional. The professionals, experts and activists. I love subject experts, and as we all must do, I rely heavily on them to understand the world. When I know, for example, that all population experts agree that population will stop growing somewhere between 10 billion and 12 billion, then I trust that data. When I know, for example, that historians, paleodemographers, and archaeologists have all concluded that until 1800, women had on average 5 or more children, but only 2 survived, I trust that data. When I know that economists disagree about what causes economic growth, that is extremely useful too, because it tells me I must be careful. Probably there is not enough useful data yet, or perhaps there is no simple explanation. I love experts, but they have their limitations. First, and most obviously, experts are experts only within their own field. That can be difficult for experts, and we are all experts in something, to admit. We like to feel knowledgeable and we like to feel useful. We like to feel that our special skills make us generally better. But highly numerate people, like the super brainy audience at the amazing meeting, an annual gathering of people who love scientific reasoning, score just as badly on our fact questions as everyone else. Highly educated people, like the readers of Nature, one of the world's finest scientific journals, score just as badly on our fact questions as everyone else, and often even worse. People with extraordinary expertise in one field score just as badly on our fact questions as everyone else. I had the honor of attending the 64th Lindau Nobel Laureate meeting and addressing a large group of talented young scientists and Nobel laureates in physiology and medicine. They were the acknowledged intellectual elite of their field, and yet on the question about child vaccination, they scored worse than any public polls. 8% got the answer right. After this, I never take it for granted that brilliant experts will know anything about closely related fields outside their specializations. Being intelligent, being good with numbers, or being well-educated, or even winning a Nobel Prize, is not a shortcut to global factual knowledge. Experts are experts only within their field. And sometimes experts are not experts even in their own fields. Many activists present themselves as experts. I have presented at all kinds of activist conferences because I believe educated activists can be absolutely crucial for improving the world. Recently, I presented at a conference of women's rights. I strongly support their cause. 292 brave young feminists had traveled to Stockholm from across the world to coordinate their struggle to improve women's access to education. But only 8% knew that 30-year-old women have spent on average only 1 year less in school than 30-year-old men. I am absolutely not saying that everything is okay with girls' education. On level one, and especially in a small number of countries, many girls still do not go to primary school, and there are huge problems with girls' and women's access to secondary and higher education. But in fact, on levels 2, 3, and 4, where 6 billion people live, Girls are going to school as much as or more than boys. This is something amazing. It is something that activists for women's education should know and celebrate. I could have picked other examples. This is not about activists for women's rights in particular. Almost every activist I have ever met, whether deliberately or more likely unknowingly, exaggerates the problem to which they have dedicated themselves. Fact question 11. In 1996, tigers, giant pandas, and black rhinos were all listed as endangered. How many of these three species are more critically endangered today? A, two of them. B, one of them. C, none of them. Humans have plundered natural resources across the planet. Natural habitats have been destroyed and many animals hunted to extinction. This is clear. But activists who devote themselves to protecting vulnerable animals and their habitats tend to make the same mistake I've just described, desperately trying to make people care they forget about progress. A serious problem requires a serious database. I strongly recommend visiting the Red List, where you can access the status of all endangered species in the world, as updated by a global community of high-quality researchers who track the wild populations of different animals and collaborate to monitor the trend. Guess what? If I check the Red List, or World Wildlife Fund, today, I can see how, despite declines in some local populations and some subspecies, the total wild populations of tigers, giant pandas, and black rhinos have all increased over the past years. It was worth paying for all those panda stickers on the doors all around Stockholm. Yet only 6% of the Swedish public knows that their support has had any effect. There has been progress in human rights, animal protection, women's education, climate awareness, catastrophe relief, and many other areas where activists raise awareness by saying that things are getting worse. That progress is, of course, at least partly thanks to these activists. Maybe they could achieve even more, though, if they did not have such a singular perspective. If they had a better understanding themselves of the progress that had been made, and a greater willingness to communicate it to those they seek to engage. It can be energizing to hear evidence of progress rather than a constant restatement of the problem. UNICEF, Save the Children, Amnesty, and the human rights and environmental movements miss this opportunity again and again. Hammers and nails. You probably know the saying, give a child a hammer and everything looks like a nail. When you have valuable expertise, you like to see it put to use. Sometimes an expert will look around for ways in which their hard-won knowledge and skills can be applicable beyond where it's actually useful. So people with math skills can get fixated on the numbers. Climate activists argue for solar everywhere, and physicians promote medical treatment where prevention would be better. Great knowledge can interfere with an expert's ability to see what actually works. All these solutions are great for solving some problem, but none of them will solve all problems. It is better to look at the world in lots of different ways. Numbers are not the single solution. I don't love numbers. I am a huge, huge fan of data. But I don't love it. It has its limits. I love data only when it helps me to understand the reality behind the numbers. That is, people's lives. In my research, I have needed the data to test my hypotheses. But the hypotheses themselves often emerged from talking to, listening to, and observing people. Though we absolutely need numbers to understand the world, we should be highly skeptical about conclusions derived purely from number crunching. The Prime Minister of Mozambique from 1994 to 2004, Pascoal Mocumbi, visited Stockholm in 2002 and told me that his country was making great economic progress. I asked him how he knew. After all, the quality of the economic statistics in Mozambique was probably not very good. Had he looked at GDP per capita? "I do look at those figures," he said, "but they are not so accurate. So I have made it a habit to watch the marches on May 1st every year. They are a popular tradition in our country. And I look at people's feet and what kind of shoes they have. I know that people do their best to look good on that day. I know that they cannot borrow their friend's shoes because their friend will be out marching too. So I look, and I can see if they walk barefoot, or if they have bad shoes, or if they have good shoes. And I can compare what I see with what I saw last year. Also, when I travel across the country, I look at the construction going on. If the grass is growing over new foundations, that is bad. But if they keep putting new bricks on, then I know people have money to invest, not just to consume day to day." A wise prime minister looks at the numbers, but not only at the numbers. And of course, some of the most valued and important aspects of human development cannot be measured in numbers at all. We can estimate suffering from disease using numbers. We can measure improvements in material living conditions using numbers. But the end goal of economic growth is individual freedom and culture. And these values are difficult to capture with numbers. The idea of measuring human progress in numbers seems completely bizarre to many people. I often agree. The numbers will never tell the full story of what life on Earth is all about. The world cannot be understood without numbers, but the world cannot be understood with numbers alone. Medicine is not the single solution. Medical professionals can become very single-minded about medicine, or even a particular kind of medicine. In the 1950s, a Danish public health doctor, Halfdan Mahler, suggested to the World Health Organization a way to eradicate tuberculosis. His project sent small buses with X-ray machines trundling around villages in India. It was a simple idea. Eradicate one disease, and it's gone. The plan was to X-ray the whole population, find those with TB and treat them. But it failed, because the people got angry. They all had tons of urgent health problems, and finally here was a bus with nurses and doctors. But instead of fixing a broken bone, or giving fluids for diarrhea, or helping a woman in childbirth, they wanted to X-ray everyone for a disease they had never heard of. Out of the failure of this attempt to eradicate one single disease came the insight that instead of fighting this disease or that disease, it is wiser to provide and gradually improve primary health care for all. In another part of the medical world, the profits of big pharma companies have been dropping. Most of them are fixated on developing a new, revolutionary, life-prolonging medicine. I try to persuade them that the next big boost in world life expectancy, and their profits, will probably come not from a pharmacological breakthrough, but from a business model breakthrough. Big Pharma is currently failing to reach huge markets in countries on levels 2 and 3, where hundreds of millions of people like the diabetes patient we met in Kerala, need drugs that have already been discovered, but at more reasonable prices. If the pharmaceutical companies were better at adjusting their prices for different countries and different customers, they could make their next fortune with what they already have. Experts in maternal mortality who understand the point about hammers and nails can see that the most valuable intervention for saving the lives of the poorest mothers is not training more local nurses to perform C-sections or better training of severe bleeding or infections, but the availability of transport to the local hospital. The hospitals were of limited use if women could not reach them, if there were no ambulances or no roads for the ambulances to travel on. Similarly, educators know that it is often the availability of electricity rather than more textbooks or even more teachers in the classroom that has the most impact on learning, as students can do their homework after sunset. Where gynecologists never put their fingers. I was talking to some gynecologists whose job it was to collect data about sexually transmitted diseases in poor communities. These professionals were ready to put their fingers anywhere on people and to ask them all kinds of questions about their sexual activities. I was interested to know whether some STDs were more common in some income groups, and so I asked them to include a question about income on their forms. They looked at me and said, "What? You can't ask people about their incomes. That is an extremely private question." The one place they didn't want to put their fingers was in people's wallets. Some years later, I met the team at the World Bank who organized the global income surveys, and I asked them to include questions about sexual activity in their survey. I was still wondering about any relationships between sexual behavior and income levels. Their reaction was more or less the same. They were happy to ask people all kinds of questions about their income, the black market, and so on. But sex? Absolutely not. It's strange where people end up drawing their lines and how well behaved they feel if they stay inside their boxes. The ideologues. A big idea can unite people like nothing else and allow us to build the society of our dreams. Ideology has given us liberal democracy and public health insurance. But ideologues can become just as fixated as experts and activists on their one idea or one solution, with even more harmful outcomes. The absurd consequences of focusing fanatically on a single idea, like free markets or equality, instead of on measuring performance and on doing what works, are obvious to anyone who spends much time looking at the realities of life in Cuba and the United States. Cuba, the healthiest of the poor. I spent some time in Cuba in 1993, investigating a devastating epidemic that was affecting 40,000 people. I had several encounters with President Fidel Castro himself, and I met many skilled, highly educated, and dedicated professionals at the Ministry of Health doing their best within an inflexible and oppressive system. Having lived and worked in a communist country, Mozambique, I went to Cuba with great curiosity, but no romantic ideas whatsoever, and I didn't develop any while I was there. I could tell you countless stories of the nonsense I saw in Cuba. The local moonshine, a toxic fluorescent concoction brewed inside TV tubes, using water, sugar, and babies' poopy diapers to provide the yeast required for fermentation. The hotels that hadn't planned for any guests and so had no food. A problem we solved by driving to an old people's home and eating their leftovers from the standard adult food rations. my Cuban colleague who knew his children would be expelled from university if he sent a Christmas card to his cousin in Miami. The fact that I had to explain my research methods to Fidel Castro personally to get approval. I will restrain myself and just tell you why I was there and what I discovered. In late 1991, the poor farmers in the tobacco-growing province of Pinar del Rio had started to go colorblind and then experienced neurological problems with a loss of feeling in the arms and legs. Cuban epidemiologists had investigated and were now seeking outside help. Since the Soviet Union had just collapsed, no help could come from that direction. And in searching the literature for the few researchers in the world with experience of neurological pandemics among poor farmers, they hit on me. Conchita Huerco, a member of the Cuban Politburo, met me at the airport. And on my first day, Fidel himself appeared, accompanied by armed guards, to check me over. His black sneakers squeaked on the cement floor as he circled round me. I spent 3 months investigating. I concluded that the poor farmers were suffering not from a mass poisoning from black market food, as rumor had it, nor from some germ causing metabolic problems, but from simple nutritional deficiency caused by global macroeconomics. The Soviet boats that had until recently been arriving full of potatoes and leaving full of Cuban sugar and cigars had not come this year. All food was strictly rationed. The people had given what little nutritious food they had to the children, the pregnant, and the old, and the heroic adults had eaten only rice and sugar. I presented this all as carefully as I could because the clear implication was that government planning had failed to provide enough food for its people. The planned economy had failed. I was thanked and sent home. 1 year later, I was invited back to Havana to give a presentation to the Ministry of Health on health in Cuba in a global perspective. The Cuban government had by this point, with the help of the Venezuelan government, regained the ability to feed the Cuban people. I showed them Cuba's special position on my health and wealth bubble chart. It had a child survival rate as high as that of the United States, on only one quarter of the income. The Minister of Health jumped on stage directly after I had finished and summarized my message. "We Cubans are the healthiest of the poor," he said. There was a big round of applause, and that turned out to be the end of the session. However, that was not the message that everyone had taken from my presentation. As I moved toward the refreshments, a young man gently grabbed my arm. He softly dragged me out of the flow of the crowd, explaining that he worked with health statistics. Then he leaned his head close to mine, and with his mouth close to my ear, he courageously whispered, "Your data is correct, but the conclusion of the minister is completely wrong." He looked at me as if it were a quiz, then answered his own question. "We are not the healthiest of the poor. We are the poorest of the healthy." He let go of my arm and swiftly walked away, smiling. Of course he was right. The Cuban minister had described things from the government's single-minded perspective, but there was also another way of looking at things. Why be pleased with being the healthiest of the poor? Don't the Cuban people deserve to be as rich and as free as those in other healthy states? The United States, the sickest of the rich. Which brings us to the United States. Just as Cuba is the poorest of the healthy because of its commitment to a single idea, the United States is the sickest of the rich. Ideologues will invite you to contrast the United States with Cuba. They will insist you must be for one or the other. If you would prefer to live in the United States than in Cuba, they say, then you must reject everything the government does in Cuba, and you must support what Cuba's government rejects, the free market. To be clear, I would definitely prefer to live in the United States than in Cuba, but I don't find it helpful to think like this. It is single-minded and very misleading. If it is being ambitious, the United States should seek to compare itself not to Cuba, a communist country on level 3, but to other capitalist countries on level 4. If U.S. politicians want to make fact-based decisions, they should be driven not by ideology, but by the numbers. And if I were to choose where to live, I would choose based not on ideology, but on what a country delivers to its people. The United States spends more than twice as much per capita on healthcare as other capitalist countries on level 4, around $9,400, compared to around $3,600. And for that money, its citizens can expect lives that are 3 years shorter. The United States spends more per capita on healthcare than any other country in the world. But 39 countries have longer life expectancies. Instead of comparing themselves with extreme socialist regimes, U.S. citizens should be asking why they cannot achieve the same levels of health for the same cost as other capitalist countries that have similar resources. The answer is not difficult, by the way. It is the absence of the basic public health insurance that citizens of most other countries on level 4 take for granted. Under the current U.S. system, rich, insured patients visit doctors more than they need, running up costs, while poor patients cannot afford even simple, inexpensive treatments and die younger than they should. Doctors spend time that could be used to save lives or treat illness, providing unnecessary, meaningless care. What a tragic waste of physician time. Actually, to be completely accurate, I should say that there is a small number of rich countries with life expectancies as low as that in the United States. The rich Gulf states of Oman, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. But these states have a very different history. Until the 1960s, when they really started getting rich on oil, their populations were poor and illiterate. Their health systems have been built in just 2 generations. Unlike the United States, these states are not constrained by a suspicion of anything governmental. And I would not be surprised if within a couple of years, they all had higher life expectancies than the United States. Perhaps the United States will then be less reluctant to learn from them than it is to learn from West European countries. The communist system in Cuba is an example of the danger of getting hooked on a single perspective. The seemingly reasonable but actually bizarre idea that a central government can solve all its people's problems. I can understand why people looking at Cuba and its inefficiencies, poverty, and lack of freedom would decide that governments should never be allowed to plan societies. The healthcare system in the United States is also suffering from the single-perspective mindset, the seemingly reasonable but actually bizarre idea that the market can solve all a nation's problems. I can understand why people looking at the United States and its inequalities and healthcare outcomes would decide that private markets and competition should never be allowed anywhere near the delivery of public goods. As with most discussions about the private versus the public sector, the answer is not either or. It is case by case, and it is both. The challenge is to find the right balance between regulation and freedom. Even democracy is not the single solution. This is risky, but I am going to argue it anyway. I strongly believe that liberal democracy is the best way to run a country. People like me who believe this are often tempted to argue that democracy leads to, or is even a requirement, for other good things, like peace, social progress, health improvements, and economic growth. But here is the thing, and it is hard to accept. The evidence does not support this stance. Most countries that make great economic and social progress are not democracies. South Korea moved from level 1 to level 3 faster than any country had ever done, without finding oil, all the time as a military dictatorship. Of the 10 countries with the fastest economic growth in 2016, 9 of them score low on democracy. Anyone who claims that democracy is a necessity for economic growth and health improvements will risk getting contradicted by reality. It's better to argue for democracy as a goal in itself instead of as a superior means to other goals we like. There is no single measure, not GDP per capita, not child mortality, as in Cuba, not individual freedom, as in the United States, not even democracy, whose improvement will guarantee improvements in all the others. There is no single indicator through which we can measure the progress of a nation. Reality is just more complicated than that. The world cannot be understood without numbers, nor through numbers alone. A country cannot function without a government, but the government cannot solve every problem. Neither the public sector nor the private sector is always the answer. No single measure of a good society can drive every other aspect of its development. It's not either or. It's both. And it's case by case. Factfulness is recognizing that a single perspective can limit your imagination, and remembering that it is better to look at problems from many angles to get a more accurate understanding and find practical solutions. To control the single perspective instinct, get a toolbox, not a hammer. Test your ideas. Don't collect only examples that show how excellent your favorite ideas are. Have people who disagree with you test your ideas and find their weaknesses. Limited expertise. Don't claim expertise beyond your field. Be humble about what you don't know. Be aware, too, of the limits of the expertise of others. Hammers and nails. If you are good with a tool, you may want to use it too often. If you have analyzed a problem in depth, you can end up exaggerating the importance of that problem or of your solution. Remember that no one tool is good for everything. If your favorite idea is a hammer, look for colleagues with screwdrivers, wrenches, and tape measures. Be open to ideas from other fields. Numbers, but not only numbers. The world cannot be understood without numbers, and it cannot be understood with numbers alone. Love numbers for what they tell you about real lives. Beware of simple ideas and simple solutions. History is full of visionaries who used simple utopian visions to justify terrible actions. Welcome complexity. Combine ideas. Compromise. Solve problems on a case-by-case basis. Chapter 9. The Blame Instinct. About magic washing machines and money-making robots. Let's beat up Grandma. I was lecturing at the Karolinska Institute, explaining that the big pharmaceutical companies do hardly any research on malaria and nothing at all on sleeping sickness or other illnesses that affect only the poorest. A student sitting in the front said, "Let's punch them in the face." "Aha," I said. "I am actually going to Novartis in the fall." Novartis is a global pharma company based in Switzerland, and I had been invited to give a lecture there. If you explain to me what I will achieve and who I should punch, I could try it. Who should I punch in the face? Is it just anybody who works there? No. It's the boss, said that guy. Aha. Okay, so it's Daniel Vasella. That was the name of the boss back then. Well, I do know Daniel Vasella a bit. When I see him in the fall, should I punch him in the face? Will everything be good then? Will he become a good boss and realize that he should change the company's research priorities? A student farther back answered, No, you have to punch the board members in the face. Well, that is actually interesting, because I will probably speak in front of the board in the afternoon. So then I'll stay calm in the morning when I see Daniel, but when I get to the boardroom, I'll walk around and punch as many as I can. I will, of course, not have time to knock everyone down. I have no fighting experience, and there is security there. So they will probably stop me after 3 or 4. But should I do that, then? You think this will make the board change its research policy? No, said a third student. Novartis is a public company. It's not the boss or the board who decides. It's the shareholders. If the board changes its priorities, the shareholders will just elect a new board. That's right, I said. It's the shareholders who want this company to spend their money on researching rich people's illnesses. That's how they get a good return on their shares. So there's nothing wrong with the employees, the boss, or the board then? Now the question is, I looked at the student who had first suggested the face punching, who owns the shares in those big pharmaceutical companies? Well, it's the rich, he shrugged. No, it's actually interesting because pharmaceutical shares are very stable. When the stock market goes up and down or oil prices go up and down, pharma shares keep giving a pretty steady return. Many other kinds of company shares follow the economy. They do better or worse as people go on spending sprees or cut back. But the cancer patients always need treatment. So who owns the shares in these stable companies? My young audience looked back at me, their faces like one big question mark. It's retirement funds. Silence. So maybe I don't have to do any punching, because I will not meet the shareholders, but you will. This weekend, go visit your grandma and punch her in the face. If you feel you need someone to blame and punish, it's the seniors and their greedy need for stable stocks. And remember last summer when you went backpacking and Grandma gave you a little extra travel money? Well, maybe you should give that back to her so she can give it back to Novartis and ask them to invest in poor people's health. Or maybe you spent it already and you should punch yourself in the face. The blame instinct. The blame instinct is the instinct to find a clear, simple reason for why something bad has happened. I had this instinct just recently when I was taking a shower in a hotel and turned the warm handle up to maximum. Nothing happened. Then seconds later, I was being burned by scorching water. In those moments, I was furious with the plumber, and then the hotel manager, and then the person who might be running cold water next door. But no one was to blame. No one had intentionally caused me harm or been neglectful, except perhaps me, when I didn't have the patience to turn the warm handle more gradually. It seems that it comes very naturally for us to decide that when things go wrong, it must be because some bad individual with some bad intentions. We like to believe that things happen because someone wanted them to, that individuals have power and agency, otherwise the world feels unpredictable, confusing, and frightening. The blame instinct makes us exaggerate the importance of individuals or of particular groups. This instinct to find a guilty party derails our ability to develop a true fact-based understanding of the world. It steals our focus as we obsess about someone to blame, then blocks our learning because once we have decided who to punch in the face, we stop looking for explanations elsewhere. This undermines our ability to solve the problem or prevent it from happening again. Because we are stuck with oversimplistic finger-pointing, which distracts us from the more complex truth and prevents us from focusing our energy in the right places. For example, blaming an airplane crash on a sleepy pilot will not help stop future crashes. To do that, we must ask, why was he sleepy? How can we regulate against sleepy pilots in the future? If we stop thinking when we find the sleepy pilot, we make no progress. To understand most of the world's significant problems, we have to look beyond a guilty individual and to the system. The same instinct is triggered when things go well. Claim comes just as easily as blame. When something goes well, we are very quick to give the credit to an individual or a simple cause, when again, it is usually more complicated. If you really want to change the world, you have to understand it. Following your blame instinct isn't going to help. Playing the blame game. The blame game often reveals our preferences. We tend to look for bad guys who confirm our existing beliefs. Let's look at some of the people we most love to point the finger at. Evil businessmen, lying journalists, and foreigners. Business. I always try to be analytical, but even so, I am often floored by my instincts. This particular time, perhaps, I had been reading too many cartoons featuring Scrooge McDuck, Donald Duck's rich, greedy uncle. Perhaps back then I was as lazy in my thinking about commercial pharma as my students were many years later. At any rate, when UNICEF asked me to investigate a bid for a contract to provide malaria tablets to Angola, I got suspicious. The numbers looked odd, and all I could think was that I was going to uncover a scam. Some dishonest business was trying to rip off UNICEF, and I was going to find out how. UNICEF runs competitive bids for pharmaceutical companies to provide it with medicines over a 10-year period. The length and size of the contracts makes them attractive, and bidders tend to offer very good prices. However, on this occasion, a small family business called Rivopharm, based in Lugano in the Swiss Alps, had put in an unbelievably low bid. In fact, the price they wanted per pill was lower than the cost of the raw materials. My job was to go over there and find out what was going on. I flew to Zurich, then took a small plane to the little airport in Lugano. I was expecting to be met by a representative of a shabby, corner-cutting outfit, but instead whisked away in a limousine and deposited at the most luxurious hotel I had ever been in. I rang home to Agneta and whispered to her, "Silk sheets." The next morning, I was driven out to the factory to inspect. I shook the manager's hand, then went straight in with my questions. "You buy the raw material from Budapest, turn it into pills, put the pills in containers, put the containers in boxes, put the boxes in a shipping container, and get the container to Genoa. How can you do all of that for less than the cost of the raw materials? Do you get some special price from the Hungarians?" "We pay the same price as everyone else to the Hungarians," he told me. "And you pick me up in a limousine? Where are you making your money?" He smiled. "It works like this. A few years ago, we saw that robotics was going to change this industry. We built this little factory with the world's fastest pill-making machine, which we invented. All our other processes are highly automated, too. The big companies' factories look like craftsmen's workshops compared with us. So, we order supplies from Budapest. On Monday at 6 a.m., the active ingredient chloroquine arrives here on the train. By Wednesday afternoon, a year's supply of malaria pills for Angola are packed in boxes ready to ship. By Thursday morning, they are at the port in Genoa. UNICEF's buyer inspects the pills and signs that he received them, and the money is paid that day into our Zurich bank account. But come on, you are selling it for less than you bought it for. That's right. The Hungarians give us 30 days credit, and UNICEF pays us after only 4 of those days. That gives us 26 days left to earn interest while the money is sitting in our account. Wow. I couldn't find the words. I hadn't even thought of that option. My mind had been blocked with the idea that UNICEF were the good guys and Pharma were the bad guys with an evil plot. I had been completely ignorant about the innovative power of small businesses. They turned out to be good guys, too, with a fantastic ability to find cheaper solutions. Journalists. It is fashionable for intellectuals and politicians to point a finger at the media and blame them for not reporting the truth. Maybe it even sounded like I was doing that myself in earlier chapters. Instead of pointing our fingers at journalists, we should be asking, why does the media present such a distorted picture of the world? Do journalists really mean to give us a distorted picture? Or could there be another explanation? I am not getting into the debate about deliberately manufactured fake news. That is something else altogether and nothing to do with journalism. And by the way, I do not believe that fake news is the major culprit for our distorted worldview. We haven't only just started to get the world wrong. I think we have always gotten it wrong. In 2013, we posted results from Gapminder's Ignorance Project online. The findings quickly became top stories on both BBC and CNN. The two channels posted our questions on their website so people could test themselves, and they got thousands of comments trying to analyze why the heck people were getting such worse-than-random bad results. One comment caught our attention. I bet no member of the media passed the test. We got excited by this idea and decided to try to test it. But the polling company said it was impossible to get access to groups of journalists. Their employers refused to let them be tested. Of course, I understood. No one likes their authority to be questioned, and it would be very embarrassing for a serious news outlet to be shown to be employing journalists who knew no more than chimpanzees. When people tell me things are impossible, that's when I get really excited to try. In my calendar for that year were 2 media conferences, so I took our polling devices along. A 20-minute lecture is too short for all my questions, but I could ask some. One of the conferences included leading documentary film producers, people from the BBC, PBS, National Geographic, the Discovery Channel, and so on. It seems that these journalists and filmmakers know no more than the general public, that is, less than chimpanzees. If this is the case for journalists and documentarians in general, and I have no reason to believe knowledge levels would be higher among other groups of reporters, or that they would have done better with other questions, then they are not guilty. Journalists and documentarians are not lying, that is, deliberately misleading us, when they produce dramatic reports of a divided world, or of nature striking back, or of a population crisis discussed in serious tones with wistful piano music in the background. They do not necessarily have bad intentions, and blaming them is pointless. Because most of the journalists and filmmakers who inform us about the world are themselves misled. Do not demonize journalists. They have the same mega misconceptions as everyone else. Our press may be free,